Okay, this is part two of the first class on le Royaume-Uni à l'épreuve de la crise. And I'd just been looking at manifestos. Manifestos, sometimes the text commentaries are on extracts from manifestos. That can be useful because they're very concentrated. They can be a little difficult to analyse. And the reason for this is because they're obliged to address the middle ground. Supposing you're writing the Labour manifesto, you're not really writing it for people who always vote Labour. They will vote Labour. You're not writing it for people who always vote Conservative. You're writing it for the people between. And this is one of the reasons that sometimes the two manifestos are more similar than you might think. They're not actually as similar. I've been looking at them very recently. They're not. You can definitely see the differences, but sometimes you have to read between the lines. Also, very typical of manifestos is to present their ideas as natural. So it's very, very common to see expressions such as "it's common sense," which of course is a standard rhetorical method. We often concentrate quite a lot, with good reason, on the general election, but remember that Britain is a much less centralised country than France, and so local councils and county councils have quite a lot of decision-making possibilities. And so even when the national government is Labour, Conservative local authorities can make quite important decisions. This is particularly the case in education, because education was notoriously decentralised until at least well into the 80s. It still is in some cases. For example, the curriculum in the 1970s, there was no national curriculum. It was decided regionally. Each region decided on the curriculum. It's a very important distinction with France. Also, bizarrely, even more bizarrely, in France, typically the left wing has defended having a national curriculum, and in England, typically it was the Conservatives who defended the national curriculum. So there you go. cultural differences there. So once you've got through the general election, you get to the House of Commons, and here you have a picture of the House of Commons at the state opening of Parliament, just before the Queen's speech. And you can see, first of all, there's a tremendous amount of ceremony. You can see at the middle here, there's the mace, and I don't understand the details of the ceremony. It's very extremely ceremonial. And of course, the new government's programme is read by the Queen. In the Queen's speech, where she says, "My government will do this, my government will do that." They're not absolutely obliged to do what they say in the Queen's speech, but it's traditional to give the general thing. Now, in the 1970s in particular, but it has happened since, you can have an election where no party has a majority, and this is what we call a hung parliament. Yeah, a hung parliament. Parlement pendu. That simply means that no party has a majority. And here you have the very close result in 1974, and I think this may have been the final result. So it was something like that, where you can see that the Labour Party have more than the Conservatives, but to have a majority, they need the Liberals or some others. So this is a situation of a hung parliament. And now this makes a big difference, because if the Labour Party came out in February 1974 with a minority government, and the problem with a minority government is that every time you have a vote in Parliament, you must persuade some of the small parties to support you. Also, every time you have a vote, every single one of your members of Parliament must be present. This is a problem. When you have 300 members of Parliament, also, are members of Parliament usually very young or very old? They tend to be rather old. And if you have 300 people who are not young, then people are ill. And this was a major problem for them. They literally brought people in with an ambulance to vote. Yes, that's also the case about sitting. But for the voting, they had to have everybody in. And this could also pose ethical questions. That is to say that the Prime Minister, I know in James Callaghan's case, there's a case where with somebody who was actually dying, and they say, you know, shall we bring him in? And eventually James Callaghan said, well, no, we need him, but, you know, I refuse to have him brought in when he's in such a bad state. So it can cause some very, very difficult questions. And one of the videos I put on the blog is called The Night the Government Died, or something like that, yeah. And it's very much about that. The other thing is, of course, the opposition is the opposition. So when Labour had a minority government, the opposition would call for a vote at 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, they do everything to make life difficult. Yeah, they do everything to make life difficult every day, just trying to make it so that the Prime Minister and the other ministers were just exhausted and preferred to have a general election. Yeah. So there's a lot of personal stuff going on. Now, inside the individual parties, there's also particular power structures. I already mentioned the Labour Party, where the most important elements are the parliamentary party, that's the members of parliament, who of course think they are important because they were elected. The constituency activists, the local parties, who think they're important because they do all the work. Now, they knock on the doors and get people to go vote. And finally, the trade unions, who provide the money, and also, initially, the Labour Party was established by the trade unions. So the trade unions often consider that it's their party, and so they should decide. Every year there is an annual Labour Party conference and an annual Conservative Party conference, which decides policy, but again, there's contested legitimacy going on. The parliamentary party, the group of MPs, makes decisions, and the Labour Party conference makes decisions, and they're not always the same decisions. For example, in the referendum of 75 for staying in the common market or leaving the common market, the Labour Party conference voted to leave the common market, but the Prime Minister from the same party campaigned to stay in. The party was very divided, and this was a very exceptional case where, in order to keep the party together, Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister, said every minister can campaign for their own ideas. Very exceptional situation. Normally, Prime Ministers don't like this. You have something called collective responsibility, that if you want to give a clear image to the country of what you're doing, the general idea is, listen, We discuss inside the cabinet among ministers, but when we've made a decision, you must not oppose our decision in public. You have two choices. Either you stay in the cabinet and you don't criticise the government in public, or you want to criticise and you leave. And you resign. That's the normal situation. It's called collective cabinet responsibility. And there are many good reasons for this, because if you want to give, you're trying to give a political lead to the country, you can't really have everybody's individual opinion. However, they made an exception for the referendum because otherwise the Labour Party was so divided that it would have been very, very dangerous for the party. This is something else that's tremendously important for the Prime Minister or for the leader of the opposition. Of course, you want to win elections. Of course. Once you win elections, you want to pass the laws which you think are good for the country. But also, you want to keep your party united, or relatively united. You want to avoid your party splitting, certainly. And these are all perfectly honourable aims, yeah? If you think that the country needs changing, and my party is the party that can change it, then going more slowly or making compromises to guarantee the unity of the party is perfectly honourable. Yeah. But all these things are going on. And here we have, that's the House of Lords. I don't know why I mentioned the House, why I wanted the House of Lords. Political, but there you go. There you have Harold Wilson at the Labour Party conference. I will come back to Harold Wilson a little later on. Let's have a look then a little bit outside politics at the trade unions. Here you have Jack Jones, one of the most important trade union leaders of the decade. There he is in 1974. The trade unions, this was certainly the decade when the trade unions were at their most powerful, I would think. Although they were very powerful in the 60s and 50s as well, it was just easier to win. Typically, in the 50s and 60s, remember, the economy was going very well. Most companies were making good profits without too much difficulty. And so when there was a strike on Tuesday morning, very often on Tuesday afternoon, the employer said, okay. So the strikes were very short. You see, when your company is making lots of profit and everything's going well, you don't want a strike. And so, you know, you make concessions easily. But when the crisis arrives and it's difficult to make profits, then the bosses are much more difficult. You want a wage rise? No. You're having a strike? Well, have a strike then. Yeah? And so the strikes get longer. So what is typical of 1970 strikes is that they are longer than 1960 strikes and 1950 strikes, that they are not so successful from the point of view of the strikers. They quite often win still in the 70s, but they're not so successful. That the government gets involved. They are bigger national strikes, whereas a typical strike from the 50s and 60s is a local strike. And very quick. In fact, very typically in the 50s and 60s in a factory, you have a strike, the manager makes a concession, the strike is over before the national union leaders have been phoned. It all happens very, very quickly. Yeah, that it's very, very local, grassroots strikes. There's a wonderful book which you don't have time to read this year, but called Working for Ford. It's written by a man who worked for Ford. And he explained how sometimes the wages were fairly good and the company was going well. And one day it was beautiful weather, which is not very frequent in Britain, of course. And so they went on strike so they could play football. Yeah. Now, why don't they do this in 2016? Because why would you not do this in 2016? You might get the sack. Remember, in the 1960s, if you get the sack, you find another job the following Monday. Yeah. I remember my father resigning from his job and finding another job the following Monday. Because that's what... When there is very low unemployment, of course, trade unions are and workers are quite powerful. Because you know they're not scared in the same way. Don't go on strike to play football today. It doesn't work anymore. That time has passed, okay? And it's quite funny, actually, because they played football and the manager came and said, what do you want? You're on strike, what do you want? And they said, well, we'd like some lime juice. Yeah. On voudrait du jus de citron vert. Yeah. Of course, this is just the wonderful joy of annoying the manager. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Okay, so trade unions. Now, the trade union leaders are a very particular social group. Remember that trade union leaders are not workers. If the strike is successful or not successful, this will not change the salary of the trade union leader. So they represent the workers, but they're not workers. And this means that they want to... they want the workers to be active. They want they want better conditions for the workers, but they don't want anything to explode. They also want to control the situation. They're an intermediate level. What happened in the 70s, which is particularly new, is the bigger and bigger conflict between trade union leaders and the Labour government. A conflict between trade union leaders and the Conservative government is just normal, you know, that's from the other side, yeah? But in the 1970s, you got more and more a conflict between trade union leaders and a Labour government. One of the reasons is that the public sector is bigger and bigger. Many, many ordinary workers work for a Labour local council or a nationalised industry or the hospitals. And so the government is their employer. And so you have this contradiction where, on the one hand, let's imagine I'm a hospital worker. On the one hand, the Labour Party is my party because it represents trade unionists and workers. On the other hand, the Labour government is my employer and they don't want me to have any higher wages because of the economic situation. You've got this contradictory situation. And that's what's very new about the 1970s. Here you have the Conservative Party conference. You also have constituency activists of the Conservative Party, but it's not so important. When people knocked on your door in Liverpool, were the Conservatives and Labour? When people knocked on your door in Liverpool, were the Conservatives and Labour? You can't remember.
Just Labour.
Just Labour, yeah. Yeah, Conservative activists are not so important. So they do have their importance.
I think the area.
Yeah, the Conservatives had no chance, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so the Conservative Party conference also important. You do get internal conflicts in the party. And this is one of the, particularly important for the 1970s, is not to imagine that the Conservative Party have an opinion and the Labour Party have an opinion. No, that's much too simple. You are obliged to notice the two or three main currents inside the Conservative Party and the two or three main currents inside the Labour Party. That's obligatory. And very typically, it can be... Well, no, I'll come back to it. I'll come back to it next week, in fact, on a particular issue. Okay, so what do we have, apart from the political parties, to understand? Well, in Northern Ireland in particular, you have paramilitary organisations. Interestingly enough, despite the strength of Scottish nationalism, there has been practically zero paramilitary activity in Scotland. I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, remember, of course, that in other countries around the world, like in the Basque country, there has been a military wing to Basque nationalism. I can't think of many other examples just off. But in the United Kingdom, the paramilitary option has been limited to Ireland. And not Scotland or Wales, although there was a direct action campaign in Wales, which I'll come back to, where they burnt people's houses. One of the problems they had in Wales is that English people were buying the houses in the village for a holiday home, a second home. And the local people couldn't buy houses anymore because the prices were too high. And so there was a political group who went around destroying people's second houses to dissuade the English from buying houses. Yeah, that's not really paramilitary. It's intermediate. It's not really paramilitary. Here's a paramilitary organisation, of course, the best known one, the Irish Republican Army. There you have some members in 1972, probably at a funeral. And of course, the 1970s is the time of a very high level of military conflict in Northern Ireland. Today in Northern Ireland, the military conflict is almost zero. Not zero, almost zero. And the 1970s was the biggest one. We'll come back to that. Another paramilitary organisation, the Ulster Volunteer Force. This is a press conference of the Ulster Volunteer Force. The Irish Republican Army, of course, an organisation working for the unity of all Ireland and the expulsion of the British troops from Northern Ireland. It's a nationalist organisation. And the UVF, the opposite, this is a paramilitary organisation working to stop the unity of Ireland and to maintain loyalty to the United Kingdom. Remember the vocabulary here. On one side you have the unionists in favour of the union with the United Kingdom, who are also called loyalists. It's the same thing, unionist, loyalist. And most of them are Protestants. On the other hand, you have the Republicans, often called nationalists. It's the same thing in this context. And most of them are Catholics. You can say you're loyalists, unionists. Yeah. Unionists, then, in British politics, has two completely different meanings. Unionists, les syndicalistes, and unionists, les unionistes, ceux qui veulent garder l'union avec l'Angleterre. Don't get them mixed up, because you will never understand anything. Also, the 1970s are the time of political movements. In particular, at the end of the decade, the campaign for nuclear disarmament had a new rise. And this, in fact, is actually from 1980, this poster, where you have Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, who was president. And it says, she promised to follow him to the end of the world. He promised to organize it. Yeah, okay, and that's the nuclear bomb behind, yeah. I think that's 1980, and on the other side then, 1979, the campaign for nuclear disarmament. The campaign for nuclear disarmament, then, very much a British phenomenon, had a first wave, 1958 to 62, huge demonstrations against nuclear weapons in favour of unilateral nuclear disarmament. That is to say, to get rid of nuclear weapons because they're either immoral or ineffective, and not to wait for some hypothetical international agreement. That's the first wave, 1958 to 62. Second wave, 79 to 83. So at the end of our decade here. And third wave, much later. So there's been three waves. It's still, you still see them around. It's very... and here you have then Edward Heath, one of the prime ministers from the 1970s. He was prime minister in 1970 till 1974. Conservative prime minister. Now, what are the motivations of the political leaders? Well, obviously they have personal motivations, they have class motivations, they have party motivations. But I just wanted to mention a couple of things that people often forget. When they pass a law, they want the law to remain. So although, supposing you're a Conservative Prime Minister and you have a Conservative majority, you have a majority, so in theory you can do what you like. However, in reality, if it's an important, supposing you want to reform education, you would like to introduce a reform in a way that it is difficult for the next government, if it's Labour, to return it. So you might, even though you have a majority, you might make some concessions to Labour ideas so that your reform will last a long time. Because remember, they don't just want to win against the other party. They actually are introducing a reform for education because they believe it will be better that way. And so they try to make it so that it will last a long time. And this is quite interesting in rhetoric. For example, the law authorising abortion and the law legalising homosexuality in 1967. Conservatives have often complained about these laws. No Conservative government has ever changed them. Now, this is very interesting because you've got the rhetoric and reality. And it can be quite important for political leaders that they want to make a change and they want the change to last. Because they're not, I think it's important not to think that politicians are in it just for the power and the money. They're certainly not in it for the money. Because the amount of work involved compared with working at the top of industry is too much. I don't believe that if the thing you're most interested in money, politics is not going to, even Conservative or Labour politics is not going to be the right thing. So let's have a look at Edward Heath. Interesting thing. So the one thing which he was most proud of was getting Britain into the European Economic Community. Edward Heath was the most European of politicians. He was delighted, and he died, I think, in 2009 or something. So he died before before Britain decided to leave the European Union again, which is good because otherwise it would probably have killed him. Harold Wilson, the other prime minister from the 1970s, there he is with his pipe. I think I said this at the Brighton conference. I assure you that my imitations are excellent, but you will never know. Harold Wilson with his pipe. Interestingly enough, somebody asked him also, what was the change that he was the most proud of? And he said it was opening the Open University. Now, the Open University is a way that you can get a university degree while working at home and going on a few courses during the holidays. It was especially aimed at women with children who couldn't go to university. And it was it's very, very big, tens of thousands of students. It has an extremely good reputation. Its textbooks are sold around the world. And it became a bit of a cause célèbre in the 70s and 80s. Many, many university people who were left-wing wanted to work at the Open University because they felt that they were able to help working class people to get university diplomas, whereas they wouldn't have been able to otherwise. And that's the thing he was the most proud of, was the Open University. Here we have Michael Foot. Michael Foot never became Prime Minister, but he was a left leader. A leader of the left of the Labour Party, and they asked him also, what was the change that you were most proud of? And he said, public lending rights. Now let me explain you what public lending rights are. It's a very simple idea. Of course, if you write a book and you then sell the book, you receive a certain percentage. Today it's usually 6% of the price. However, if your book is in libraries, and many, many people are reading it in libraries, in the 1960s, you got nothing. And Michael Foot introduced a reform so that authors receive a little bit of money every time their book is borrowed. I have a book, I've only written one book, and every time somebody borrows my book in England, I receive 6p. Now, it's not a lot, but it actually does allow quite a lot of authors who are fairly popular to live on it, yeah. And so this is interesting because it obviously it's not the biggest reform in the world, but that's also important. That it's important to remember the motivations of politicians. They are interested in helping a particular group and making particular reforms as well. They're not only interested in the huge, big, world-changing things. I just gave you these three examples, so it's something to remember that really the depth of political life. Okay, I want to have a little look at the economy now. That's politics. Move on to the economy here. You'll need to know a little bit. You're not supposed to be experts in economics, and they will not give you a text commentary, which is technical economics. Partly because half of my colleagues wouldn't understand it either. However, you're supposed to know something about currency, the decisions that governments can make, that they can. You probably noticed in the recent months since the referendum, the pound has become less valuable. If this is a good time to go on holiday to England, because everything is like 12% cheaper than it was last year, which is something. Yeah. And the government has to decide if they're going to devalue or not, and the Bank of England, in this case, intervenes to buy pounds to protect the level, because if you buy a lot of pounds, the price goes up, etc. The other thing, which is rather specific to the British economy in the 1970s, is the idea of reserve currency. That is to say that many, many of the ex-colonies of Britain for a long time kept their reserves, that is their national savings, and they kept it in pounds, in sterling. That is to say that there was that probably half of the sterling which existed in the world was not being spent, it was just being kept by governments. Now, there is an advantage. The advantage to the British economy is that there is a little bit of money involved. You pay a little bit to keep it. I don't know exactly how it works, but there's some servicing money coming in. But there is a disadvantage. And the disadvantage is that if the countries suddenly sell a lot of pounds, this makes a big instability for the British economy. And so, in the 1960s and 1970s, governments decided that they didn't want sterling to be a reserve currency anymore. So, little by little, they encouraged other countries not to keep enormous billions of pounds in the cupboard, if you like. And this was important because when Britain was a superpower in the 19th century, this was okay. But this was one of this was part of the heritage of being a superpower. But of course, Britain was not a superpower anymore. And in fact, a lot of the history of the 20th century is the British elite very slowly understanding that they're not a superpower anymore. Of course, governments also have to worry about inflation, unemployment, and social spending. All of these were very, very important. Inflation was tremendously high in the 1970s. At one point it was 25% Can you imagine 25% inflation? That means that you say to yourself, shall I buy a washing machine? If I buy it in next year, in 1 year's time, it will be 25% more expensive. So this is obviously it's very stressful. Inflation is very stressful. It was 10%, then 50%, then 20%, very, very, very stressful. The people who hate inflation most are the middle classes, because they have savings. He's utterly pound you. And if you have savings, I don't, but if you had savings, if you have, you know, 50,000 euros in savings, and inflation is 20%, in 5 years, you know, it's very bad if you have savings, inflation. This does not worry the working class very much. They don't have savings. That's a general rule, yeah. Unemployment, on the other hand, worries mostly the working class. And unemployment, I don't think I can exaggerate the importance of the return of mass unemployment in the 70s. Everybody knew that mass unemployment had disappeared forever. Knew, maybe as you're savvy. In the 1930s, there was mass unemployment. The old people still remembered. You couldn't buy shoes for your children. The mother didn't eat because there was only enough food for the children. The people remembered that. In the 1950s, no unemployment. Well, during the war, no unemployment during the war. If you were not killed or injured in the Second World War, you lived better than 10 years earlier. In the 50s, no unemployment. People thought, it's wonderful. The 60s, no unemployment. Hey, unemployment has gone forever. We had never seen, par des 30 glorieuses, on n'avait jamais vu 30 glorieuses avant. On avait parfois vu 5 glorieuses. And so, the most important thing to remember is that we always say that the 30 glorieuses finished in 1975, approximately. People, 2 years before, people did not say, oh, on a fait 28 des 30 glorieuses, il ne reste que 2 ans. Yeah, absolutely not, absolutely not. Almost everybody was convinced that mass unemployment had disappeared forever. And so when it came back, it was a terrible psychological trauma. And one thing, for example, is that my impression is that today, supposing you were all talking at the bar and somebody said, oh, I think that unemployed people, it's just because they're lazy. I think that today that would be a rather unusual opinion. But in the 1970s, this was a common opinion because there had been no unemployment. And sometimes this could be quite tragic. I know that my father believed that unemployed people were lazy, and then he lost his job and he was unemployed for 5 years. And so, you know, he didn't believe it anymore, but you know, it takes a long time to. So the mass unemployment was tremendously demoralizing, I think even more so than today, because it was new. Okay, taxation. You need to know something about taxation. Now, taxation has a bad press. No, you don't normally see people say, oh, I really like taxation. Oh, I love tax. But of course, you know, if you don't have tax, you'll have no hospitals, no schools, no universities. You've got to have tax. And the most important things that governments do to tax is, first of all, they decide between direct taxation and indirect taxation. What is direct taxation? It's taxation on your income. Yeah? You earn 20,000 euros a month, let's say. Okay, and so a certain percentage you have to pay in tax. That's direct taxation. Direct taxation is paid mostly by people who have more money than average. The poor people don't pay income tax in most countries in the world, and certainly in Britain. If you're poor, you don't pay income tax. There's a minimum. However, indirect taxation is what you is what you pay when you buy something. For example, VAT. Which is introduced during the 1970s in Britain. Very different. Everybody pays indirect taxation. If you're very poor, you still pay indirect taxation. And so, in general, the move from direct to indirect taxation during the 1970s is a move which is harder for poorer people. And this will be a major change of the Thatcher governments will be to move to make indirect taxation much more important. Now, if I go back a moment to direct taxation, income tax rates, direct taxation was much higher in the 1970s. If you earned a very high wage, you could pay you paid far more income tax than today. On a more general scale of economy, you're going to need to have a general idea of what is Keynesianism. Well, maybe you know already. Would you want to give me a quick definition of Keynesianism? She's looking at me like she doesn't like anymore. Okay, right. So basically, the Keynesian idea, in very, very general terms, you don't need to be an expert on this, but you need to know, it's the idea that it is the government's job to invest, to create employment. That if you have a crisis and there's unemployment, then it's a good idea for the government to build more hospitals. This is what Roosevelt did in America. This is the general idea, and it's for a high level of government intervention. And in the 1970s, this is being contested inside the Conservative Party, and also to a lesser extent inside the Labour Party, and the rising theory, which will never completely dominate, even today you have some Keynesianism around, is what we call monetarism. And it is represented by a number of thinkers, including this guy, Dr. Milton Friedman, who wrote the book Capitalism and Freedom in 1940-something, I think. I'm not sure of the date of the book, but it's before the 1970s. And monetarism is among other things, I'm not an expert on this, is the idea that it's a bad thing for the government to create unemployment, that unemployment is an acceptable risk that will help to regulate the market, that controlling the money supply is the most important job that governments have to do. And in general, this is linked to the politics of neoliberalism. Yeah, less government intervention, fewer rights for trade unions, more privatization, etc., etc. But this is the conflict between these two theories and others is what we would call a war of position. It's not a big battle where one of them loses. It's a war of position where a little bit of Keynesianism is taken away and a little bit of monetarism is put in its place. Many, many different conflicts. Just to give you an example for today, in Britain, the trains are private. The railway has been privatised. And in France, the railway is nationalised. And also, for the moment, no political party in France says, we're going to privatise the railways. Because no political party in France thinks this would be popular, I think. So that's a little bit of a Keynesian idea, which is in a different position in France and in Britain. So when I say it's a war of position, I mean, there are 100 different aspects of society which are influenced by government intervention, and neoliberalism in Britain has taken some of them away, sometimes big ones. Yeah. So it's a continual conflict. Let's move over to trade unions, and I want to give you a little bit of trade union vocabulary, which will be important for the 1970s. First of all, inside the factory, there's an enormous difference between piece work and measured day work. Piece work is you are paid for every piece. You work in a car factory, you are paid for every door which you make. Yeah? So if you work faster, you make more money. Yeah? Also, this was typical in many, many factories in the 50s and 60s. This gave a tremendous amount of influence to the local trade union, because what would happen is, you know, I don't know how cars are made, but suppose you're making a door for a car, not one door for one car, but one door for each car. Well, of course, very regularly the doors change because the models change. And so you say, this new door, this is a little bit more complicated. Let's negotiate how much are we being paid for the new door. So it was continual negotiation on a local basis for the value of the latest piece. And this is also a moment when all the genius of workers for fooling managers goes into action, because of course first of all you say, well, make this new one and we'll watch you, and the expert workers have a way of making the door to make it look more complicated than it is. Yeah. So, okay, it's reasonable. And of course, once the inspector is not there, then they make it in the simple way. It's just an age old tradition. So that's piecework. Advantage for the workers is that it gives a lot of influence to local trade unions. This was replaced in many, many factories slowly by measured day work. You get paid for the day. So you still have a negotiation, because the negotiation is how many doors in a day. But nevertheless, this is measured day work. And this reduced massively the influence of local trade unions. And indeed, one of the main reasons it was introduced was to reduce the influence of local trade unions. The closed shop. Tremendously important tradition. What is the closed shop? A very simple idea. The closed shop is quite simply an agreement between the trade unions and the management that every worker in the factory, or every worker in the hospital, or every worker in the office building must be a member of the trade union. It's a closed shop. Obviously, this has an advantage for the trade union. Yeah, every new person who arrives, the manager says, oh, you know that you have to be a member of the trade union. Oh, okay. So every new worker who joins the trade union, obviously the trade union is happy. Very often, this might sound a little bizarre, but very often the management is happy too. Because if you have trade union, if you're a manager and you have trade unions in the factory, it's simpler if there's only one trade union. Yeah. It has a certain advantage of simplicity. So, of course, this is different in different factories, but it was not unusual for managers to feel that the closed shop was a good idea. The worst thing, if you're a manager, is to have three different trade unions in your factory who are competing to show who can be the most militant, for example. Now, the closed shop doesn't exist in Britain today. It's illegal. This is Margaret Thatcher's. But in the 1970s, it was quite important. Now, this caused a certain number of debates, mostly in the 1980s, where the Conservatives would say, well, the closed shop is not democratic because people have the right not to join trade unions. It was a big, big debate in the 1970s. And the trade unions would reply, well, the people who are not members of trade unions do not refuse the wage rises that we gain. They don't refuse the holiday pay that we win for them. So really, everybody should be a member of a trade union. Otherwise, they are cheats and thieves. Yeah, so there is no solution to this argument. This is two different ideologies which are in conflict. You can't you agree with one or you agree with the other, but you can't make them agree with each other because they're beginning from different places. Oh, pickets. Now, this was also be tremendously important. In fact, closed shops and pickets are two of the most important things which become much more difficult in the 80s under Thatcher. They are major priorities of Margaret Thatcher to reduce. But in the 1970s, very important. So a picket, very simply, is something that you do when you're on strike. And typically, you have a factory on strike, and in front of the factory, you have 10 people. And when the lorries arrive to deliver coal or supplies, you talk to the driver, say, oh, listen, we're on strike. We would like you to go home. We would like you to refuse to deliver because we're on strike. And half the time, the drivers say, oh, yeah, no, I'm a trade unionist too. I know that you would support me if I was on strike. So, okay, I support you. I'm going home. I will not cross the picket line. And in the 50s and 60s, this was a very important trade union principle. You really could lose all your friends if you crossed a picket line. That's not an exaggeration in any way. I knew in the mining villages in Yorkshire, there were people who had refused to strike in 1926. And 50 years later, the local shops refused to serve them. Now, The reason this was particularly strong in the miners, because in the mines, a good union was literally a matter of life and death. Yeah, the safety regulations were imposed because the union was strong. And so this is the reason why it's so strong. A picket very often is quite a low-key affair, but sometimes it is a mass picket. Now, the mass picket is a little bit different, because a typical picket is to persuade the drivers or the workers who are not striking to stop. A mass picket is to stop them, because there are hundreds of you or thousands of you, so the lorry cannot get through, is to force them to stop. So it's rather different. A flying picket is a picket which travels around the country. Yeah, travels from place to place during the miners' strike. This was quite a new idea. This was a 1970s idea. In the 1960s and 1950s, we didn't have flying pickets. So this was, for example, when the miners were on strike in 1972, buses of miners would say, right, on Monday we're going to try to stop this mine or this factory which deals with coal or this distribution depot. And when we have stopped it, we leave just one person to watch it. We all together go to the next place. There's a flying picket. A secondary picket is to picket outside a workplace where you do not work. So, for example, you're a factory which makes chairs, and you're on strike, and it's a long strike or a difficult strike, and so you go to the factory which makes the wood for your chairs, and you ask the workers there to go on strike in solidarity with you. And in the 60s and 70s, this was possible. People went on strike in solidarity with others. In fact, in the most famous case, which was not common, but it happened, there was the nurses in one part of the country, because it was a regional thing. The nurses were quite badly paid, but they didn't want to go on strike because they're nurses, yeah? And the miners went on strike for a day, demanding more money for the nurses. Now, this was very 1970s, yeah? That was the idea of union solidarity. I don't think, you don't see it in Britain today, but it's quite interesting, because that's quite a symbol of, you know, the level of union power, but also of union solidarity. Now, if you're not actually on strike, there are other things you can do instead to put pressure on the employer. One is a go slow. On dit souvent en français une grève de zèle. That is, you do your work, but you just work slowly. Again, this is something which is much easier in a situation where there's very little unemployment, so the boss doesn't want to sack you. Yeah. Or you can go to a work to rule. Now, a work to rule is where you follow exactly all the rules. In the university, this would be funny, because if we followed exactly all the rules, we could stop working, really, you know. So, for example, you say, oh, well, you know, you know that there are a lot of safety regulations, and normally they are approximately followed. But if you're on a work to rule, you follow every rule. And, of course, it makes work impossible, in fact. And finally, very important for the 1970s, the overtime ban. C'est un peu mal nommé. En fait, c'est exactement un refus collectif de supplémentaire. That is to say that all the workers in the factory or in the mine or in the hospital say, okay, we're not happy with the employer for this reason, until they agree to give us this or this or this, we all refuse overtime. Now, this is a problem for many employers, because they very often need you to work your overtime when there's a lot of orders, etc., to keep customers happy. They must keep customers happy. So an overtime ban, it doesn't sound so bad, but it can cause a lot. And a final example, a work-in, which is to occupy the factory and continue to work. For example, if the threat is redundancies, if the threat is you're going to lose your jobs, well, going on strike is might not be a great idea. If they're going to lose your job, so we'll stop working then. And a work-in, that is an occupation. It's an occupation of a factory. Again, very 1970s. There were a lot of them in the 1970s. We will see some of them. Couple of pictures. Here you have a mass picket at Shrewsbury. You can see the demand there, £30 now. Okay, so a few final general concepts. I'm just going to be on general concepts this week. Decolonization. Remember that decolonization is mostly something going on in the 1960s. Hundreds of ex-British colonies got their independence in the 1960s. Hundreds. But there were still some more arriving in the 1970s. Two ex-colonies continued to cause problems. I mean, well, many, but in particular two continued to cause problems in the 1960s. Cyprus had gained its independence, but Britain still had a role in its governance in the 1970s, Cyprus was claimed both by Greece and Turkey. So a very exceptional colony because it's in Europe, it almost caused a war between Greece and Turkey in the 1970s. And so that's an ex-colony, also part of the reason for the conflict was Britain's colonial governance, that they had encouraged a division between the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots. The second ex-colony, which caused troubles in the 1970s, is Rhodesia, which today is Zimbabwe. And what happened in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, is that the British government was hoping that, in the same way as many other colonies in Africa, the local whites would accept a relatively democratic system, and they would be able to establish independence with a vote for everybody. From one point of view, this was a bit cheeky of the British colonialists. It's like today, I find very, very amusing how the British government says, it's a scandal in Hong Kong that China is not democratic with Hong Kong. Hong Kong was British for 200 years, and there was never one election. So I think that they could at least, keep quiet. In Africa, this was a little bit similar. So for all the time that Britain was the colonial master, black people could not vote. But normally, on independence was also, in other countries, was also the beginning of democracy. And in Rhodesia, they had a problem, because the white community was quite big, relatively big, compared with other ones. It was a little bit, c'est un peu les pieds noirs version Rhodesia. The whites local were around a guy called Ian Smith, who absolutely refused that black people should vote on the same terms as white people. And so the British government was stuck. They wanted Rhodesia to be independent, because all the free colonies were independent one by one, but they couldn't agree. They refused to agree independence without democracy. Now, why did they refuse to agree? One of the reasons is that they wanted to have good relations with the other countries in Africa. And, of course, supporting a white supremacist government was not such a good idea. In any case, the outcome was that the white Rhodesians declared independence in what we call a unilateral declaration of independence. And that was the situation during the 1970s. A few people said Britain should send the army to Rhodesia to defend democracy. But the British government was not interested in that. And certainly politically it would have been rather difficult for them, because what would the British population have thought of, white Britons being sent to attack white people in Rhodesia? And I say that advisedly. Certainly, in general, racism was much stronger in the 1970s. Don't worry, there's plenty of racism in Britain today. But there's no comparison. When I was a teenager at school, I heard racist jokes every day. There was none. normal. It was horrible, but it was normal. So that's certainly, and some of the television programs which were acceptable in the 1970s, which would not be acceptable today. Certainly, that's a big change. Okay, so coming back into Europe, obviously the European Economic Community is a major question in the 1970s, just like the European Union is a major question today. Within the United Kingdom, there is the question of Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and here you have the referendum again. For 1970, 1979. First of all, are there any questions so far? Is everything brutally clear? That's good. Well, I got to the end of my general concepts, that took much longer than I thought, but that's okay. That means I don't have to prepare so much for next week. Next week I'm going to begin by going through fairly briefly in about three quarters of an hour the videos on the blog. So if you have seen some of them and you have questions, I mean the things that you didn't understand, I don't mean what did he say in minute 17, yeah, but some of the ideas are quite complicated. Yeah. And also, remember, these are television documentaries. Now, I chose them carefully. There are many which I am not putting on the blog, because they are too simplistic or too partisan. Yeah, too partisan. And so I've selected them. But they can be quite complex. And also, I probably their biggest fault, compared with history books, is that they like to be a little melodramatic. Yeah, television is a very highly competitive field, and if you want people to watch your documentary, it can be a little melodramatic. I mean, of course, many dramatic things did happen. So try to imagine what it would be like if it's a little less dramatic. And I remember that, just to talk to you about the very first one, which is post number one, which is Wilson versus Heath, the 10-year duel, which is a lot of fun. How many people have seen or listened to this? Just so far, okay. I do recommend this one because these are the two main prime ministers in the 1970s. Also, James Callaghan later on, and this presents them a little bit as a personal competition. Now, I'm sure it exaggerates the personal element because, in fact, on each side they really thought they had the best ideas to run Britain in a better way. But nevertheless, it is quite interesting because they were both rather unusual prime ministers. First of all, Edward Heath did not come from the aristocracy. This was exceptional for a Conservative Party leader. The aristocracy, or at least the top bourgeois, they came from high up. David Cameron, well, of course, he's not the leader anymore, it's Theresa May, but David Cameron is related to the Queen. Okay, he's the sixth cousin or something, he's related to the Queen. And so Edward Heath was a more ordinary person, went to a grammar school, went to a state school, and in fact, he was chosen partly for this reason, because Harold Wilson had a working class image. He always wore a cheap coat and smoked a pipe. It's not an accident. Images are important. And his opponent in the 1960s was Sir Alec Douglas Home, the Conservative Party leader, an aristocrat, an open aristocrat. And Harold Wilson was an excellent politician, and he didn't waste time. So, of course, if you're an aristocrat, vote for him. But if you're not, vote for me. It was a very open question. And the Conservative Party, we need a leader who's not an aristocrat. And they chose Edward Heath. Very interesting guy. Never married, never seems to have had a partner, male or female. Great lover of classical music and sailing. And a tremendous believer in the Alliance of European Nations and the European Union and so on. And he won in 1970, but he lost in 1966 and in 1974 twice. And he eventually, when he lost in 1974, he had to resign. And so We should talk about the 10-year duel. Now, as I mentioned, it's a bit of an exaggeration, a duel. It's not really personal. And also, it's important to remember that when you become Prime Minister, think about this, if you're going to become Prime Minister, you need, it really is a team job. You cannot work on everything. Your ministers do most of the work. You have 20 ministers, 20 specialists, and they do most of the work, and you kind of guide it. It really is not so personal. Also, you can't do what you want. When you become Prime Minister, you have to choose 20 ministers, and of course you choose those who are close to you if possible, but you need to keep the party happy. So if there's a minority who don't really have the same, supposing 30% of the party don't really have the same ideas as you, well, you better choose a few ministers from their ideas. Not the most important ministers, because, hey, you're the Prime Minister. But it's a very difficult thing to do. So I will be talking to you more about these videos. Do try to find some time to see them. And remember, I highly recommend that you convert them into MP3 files. That's how I've done it. I've listened to 200 hours since April. And some of them were very bad, and I'm not putting them on the blog, but some of them are very good. And that's time for today, and I will see you at the same time, same channel, next week.
This is the